Welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The wonders of ancient Egypt have fascinated scholars for centuries, no scholar more so than our guest today. He's Dr. Donald Redford, a professor of Egyptology in the departments of Classics and Ancient Mediterranean Studies and History at Penn State University. He's also the 2011 Strickland Lecturer at MTSU, where he will deliver an address, free and open to the public, of course, at 7 p.m. October 20th in the State Farm Lecture Hall of the Business and Aerospace Building here on campus. And if you didn't catch all that, stay tuned. You'll hear it again, and you'll hear Donald Redford after these pearls of wisdom from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU has for the second consecutive year made the list of military-friendly schools, an annual rating by GI Jobs. The publication surveyed more than 7,000 schools nationwide, and 1,231 were selected for the honor. Military-friendly schools actively recruit and retain veterans. More than 1,000 veterans are currently enrolled at MTSU. The university will soon issue tornado warning alerts based on technology provided by AccuWeather, a private company with a team of meteorologists who provide customized and site-specific weather warnings for universities and corporations across the nation. And beginning New Year's Day, MTSU will join approximately 250 other institutions around the country by declaring the campus tobacco-free. For MTSU News anytime, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. Donald Redford joins us now via telephone from State College, Pennsylvania. He is an internationally renowned scholar of ancient Egypt and biblical studies and a noted expert on the 18th dynasty Amarna period. Professor Redford is the author of several books, including Akhenaten, The Heretic King, and Israel, Canaan, and Egypt in Ancient Times, The City of Ramman, The Story of Ancient Mendes, and numerous articles. He's been frequently featured in series and documentaries on A&E, the History Channel, and the BBC. He's been the director of important research projects, including the Akhenaten Temple Project and the Mendes excavations. Welcome, sir. Thanks for being our guest today.
Oh, thank you very much.
Your Strickland lecture is titled Mendes, City of the Ram and Fish, Microcosm of Ancient Egypt. What does City of the Ram and Fish mean, and why is this particular city a microcosm of ancient Egypt more so than the better-known cities, in the West anyway, of Cairo and Alexandria?
Yes, well, the ram and fish represent the two animals that were worshipped at the site from time immemorial, from prehistoric times. The site itself, we have now determined, was occupied in the 4th millennium B.C. and perhaps even in the 5th. And it was occupied right on down to about 600 years ago, making it one of the longest-lived cities in ancient Egypt. It was, for a time, the capital of the country, so that it did have a political importance. And we have found that through excavation that the city was occupied pretty much over that span of maybe 4,000 years, uninterrupted. And that makes it a very valuable resource of historical and religious evidence for the reconstruction of Egyptian, the political structure and the religion of the country.
You say it was occupied uninterrupted. Does that mean to say that they were successfully able to fend off invaders or that they had no invaders?
They had very few invaders. Egypt was lived a charmed life in ancient times because of its geographic location. It was hemmed in by deserts on both sides and by cataracts on the Nile on the south. So it didn't have to worry too much about invasion. But at Mendes, sometimes, of course, in antiquity, you have a site that's abandoned, perhaps for a variety of reasons. I think most Egyptian cities at one time or another were abandoned, but Mendes was not. Mendes continues being occupied right on through all these millennia, in fact.
Why is Mendes no longer the capital of Egypt?
Oh, well, it was the capital for a very short time in the 4th century B.C., and then the local elite, the families of the nobility, fell to feuding among themselves. And then finally, in 343 BC, the Persians invaded the country. This is one of the few successful invasions. And they did a number on Egyptian cities and various monuments, destroying them completely. So at that point, Mendes lost its importance.
The elites couldn't agree among themselves. That's a familiar story. We've heard that many times in history, haven't we?
Oh, we have indeed, yes.
In your research into the city of Mendes, what has been the biggest surprise for you?
Yes. Well, there were two surprises. First was the degree of destruction that the Persians in that year, 343 BC, wrought on the site. They really sacked it. Nobody had realized that before. No one had really thought that the Persian invasion had been destructive. And now I think we know it was. But I'm also impressed by something that was completely unheralded and which dates from 2200 BC. And that is the collapse of the city. It was not completely abandoned, but its prominence and its wealth that had been accrued during the third millennium, that is the Pyramid Age, suddenly fell to a catastrophe. We don't know exactly what happened, but we found a massacre of 35 skeletons who had been murdered and thrown into a deep depression in front of the temple. Then the temple had been set on fire, and the whole conflagration cascaded over the bodies, sealing them. And nobody came back to retrieve them and give them proper burial. It was a very grisly discovery, and I was totally taken by surprise.
When an archaeologist starts to get the idea about where to dig, you start with a hypothesis about where artifacts can be found, much like a scientist in a laboratory starts with a hypothesis? How do you know where to dig?
Okay, the general sites themselves are well marked. In the ancient Middle East, they're usually marked by mounds. Of ruined mud brick and that sort of thing. So that's not a problem. But finding where in a very large city, and in fact Mendes, the present, it's very well preserved, actually. That's the reason we went there. And from north to south, it measures about 2 miles, which is pretty big for an ancient city. And in that area, we were helped by a variety of types of evidence. First of all, we did magnetometer studies. Remote sensing, which will give you a pattern of walling systems beneath the ground. That will help. But also, in the case of Mendes, we had an ancient Egyptian hieroglyphic inscription coming from the reign of a king who had visited the site of Mendes when it was in its heyday. And he describes where he went, the streets he went down, the buildings he saw, and how he made the circuit of the entire city. And that stela, that inscription, has survived, and it's fairly well known. I've translated it. And using that, we've tried to follow the course that this king took around the site, and it's worked.
We'll be back in 30 seconds with more with Dr. Donald Redford, the 2011 Strickland Lecturer at MTSU.
Tennessee's farm families contribute to our state's economy, nutrition, and culture. The Tennessee Century Farms program at MTSU's Center for Historic Preservation acknowledges farms that have been in the same family for at least 100 years. To date, the program has certified more than 1,000 farms. This is Kenita Hankins, director of the Tennessee Century Farms program.
And for all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Jenna Logue back with you on MTSU on the Record. Our guest, Dr. Donald Redford, Egyptologist at Penn State University and the 2011 Strickland Lecturer here at MTSU. Dr. Redford, is it difficult to obtain permission to conduct an archaeological dig in Egypt?
No, in fact, quite the reverse. They're very generous people, and there are hundreds of foreign excavations going on in the country today. They do insist, of course, and this is quite right, on the excavator having proper credentials. And having a staff that is composed of scientists and not simply amateur treasure hunters. So one signs a contract with the Egyptian government, And they assign what they call an inspector, who is really a liaison man, and then you're invited to take the field. The security police, of course, have to pass everybody, but that is almost pro forma. And so once all these letters have been written and the red tape has been dealt with, then one goes to the site, and it's fairly straightforward.
Are the Egyptians strict about what can be done with what is extracted?
Yes. There is an old law still on the books that the excavator can have what is called a division of the objects found with the government. But that is really has fallen into abeyance, and no one even expects a division now. Egypt is really in line with such other states as Turkey or Israel or Greece or Italy in denying the excavator the option of taking anything out of the country. But that doesn't mean you can't study it. You can study it there in the country for years on end. And the Egyptians will always ask, are you finished? Are you finished? Can we put it away now? And so, they're very very generous and lenient.
This may be a bit of an inane question, but I feel compelled to ask it. Mendes is, I understand, about 2 hours north of Cairo.
Right.
Has the departure of President Hosni Mubarak and the Arab Spring uprisings or any other aspect of the recent political upheaval in the region had any impact whatsoever on your activities?
No, not yet. And I'm hoping, and I don't expect any, but we went over in June just to reconnoiter the site. I have a house there, too, right on the site, a 20-roomed house. It's really a small institute. And I was concerned that all the stories that one was getting in the news about robberies and things of that sort. But, in fact, the entire area is just as I left it. The house is intact. There is a museum very close to us, and that was totally safe. The storerooms were safe, and nothing had happened. I was quite gratified by this. So we're going back this coming summer.
So do you find that people from all walks of life in Egypt have sort of more or less an equal respect for the necessity to preserve their country's antiquities?
There are some, of course, who, through perhaps poor education, don't seem to realize the necessity. But the well-educated certainly do, and they realize, of course, and this is a fact of life in Egypt, that tourism is predominant. And if the tourists don't have anything to see, well, they won't come.
Why is ancient Egypt, or why has ancient Egypt been apparently more intriguing to you personally than other ancient cultures, Greece, Rome, Persia, the Indus Valley, etc.?
I do have interest in those areas, very much so. It's just that right now, through specialization, my bread and butter comes from Egypt. But I was brought up in a very strict conservative fundamentalist family, in fact, and the Bible was drummed into me from a very early age. That had the effect of opening all sorts of fascinating doors to me through the Bible and Bible lands. And I became interested in Greece, of course, and in Mesopotamia, and in Rome, and the entire panoply of ancient history just fascinated me, and still does. But I was especially fascinated from the age of six, I think it was, when my mother showed me in the National Geographic a number of beautiful painted reconstructions of life in ancient Egypt. And from that point on, I didn't turn back. I went on. I've been trained as a Hebraist, and I can teach Hebrew, and I have a smattering of Arabic and the other languages of the Middle East, mainly the ancient languages. But it was when I got to Egypt that I really felt that I was fulfilling myself in learning the language, the history, and latterly the archaeology.
What sort of an impact has your work as an Egyptologist had on your own spirituality or spiritual beliefs?
To be perfectly frank, I've left behind my early belief system, that which came to me from my mother and father. I'm now an agnostic, I admit it.
Nothing to be ashamed of at all.
Oh, well, maybe not. My mother wouldn't say so. Well, bless her soul, she's long since departed. But anyway, if one speaks of spirituality, it is in a sense linked to aesthetics. I'm very overwhelmed sometimes by the beauty of the arts of ancient Egypt, but also of Greece and Rome. It just carries me away. So spiritual, perhaps, in that limited sense.
Or spiritual, perhaps, in the sense of what an entire civilization of human beings can do to create their own culture, their own music, their own dance, their own intellectual curiosity in that regard.
Yes, that's true, yes.
Let's talk a bit about a discovery for which you're widely known, the Temple of Akhenaten, King Tut's father-in-law. Where did you find it, and what is its greater significance?
Yes, we discovered it at the city where Akhenaten came to the throne, which is Thebes, the modern Luxor, the second largest city in ancient Egypt. That's where his father, Amenophis III, had taken up residence late in his reign, and where the young prince Amenophis was first brought up. He was the representations of him show him as a rather ugly, misshapen individual, and there is a debate as to whether we should take that seriously. But probably something was wrong with him. He wasn't in line to the throne. His older brother would have come to the throne had he lived. But the older brother died, and Akhenaten was now, warts and all, in line for the throne. And we discovered his early temple. He was, of course, from a certain point in his reign, a monotheist. And we discovered his temple on the east side, facing the rising sun, in, 1976. We actually made the initial discovery, and then we're excavating it for the next 20 years. It badly destroyed, terribly destroyed, in fact, but we were able to find several thousand fragments of the reliefs that adorned the walls of the temple, and its importance is that it represents the very first building he put up in which he broadcast his devotion to a single god. And in order to do that, he invented a new art style, actually, which some modern art historians have compared with Expressionism. I'm not an art historian, so I don't know if that's valid or not. But it's based on the misshapen figure of himself. Everybody around him adopts his shape in this art style. It's a very naturalistic art style. He was fascinated with nature, with wild animals, plants, and trees, and that sort of thing. So actually, when you see this art, it looks frightfully modern, and it seems to be talking directly to us, whereas the art of Egypt from other periods is more stiff and hieratic, and it doesn't really... I feel it's beautiful, admittedly, but it's a little bit alien to me.
I have to, before we go to break again, describe this Akhenaten as Marianne Eaton Krauss described him in the Oxford Encyclopedia of Ancient Egypt, which you edited. She wrote, he has a hanging chin, thick lips, sunken cheeks and slanting eyes, narrow shoulders, fleshy chest, swelling thighs, pendulous abdomen and full buttocks, in marked contrast to spindly limbs and a scrawny neck. Brad Pitt he was not.
Well, that says it pretty well.
We'll take one more quick break and we'll be right back with more MTSU on the record after this.
The Middle Tennessee State University Women's Studies Research Series features compelling monthly talks on gender-related topics by faculty and graduate students. The series offers a chance to learn about research in progress and to chat with faculty in an informal setting. All lectures are free and open to the public and are held on the MTSU campus. This is Associate Professor of Journalism, Dr. Jane Marcellus.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. Donald Redford is our guest today, Egyptologist from Penn State University, State College, Pennsylvania, and the 2011 Strickland Lecturer at MTSU. Let's talk about the logistics of organizing digs, Dr. Redford. How do you determine which students will go with you, how many do you take, and what do they do when they get there?
Yes. Well, there is a kind of a roster that one has to fill out of scientists and scholars. I need, for example, a surveyor. I need a geologist, a paleobotanist, a physical anthropologist, artists galore, if I can get them, and all sorts of other ancillary skills that will contribute to not only the excavation, but to the publication after the excavation. Now, not all of these people have to be in the field, but most of them I would like to be out there. Then we need the unskilled labor, as it were, the students in training. In fact, I have my own stable of experts, so that's not a problem, and the problem is getting them to come at the time I need them. But the students seem to simply line up for it, and I have been in the habit of taking those who have some definite expertise that could be contributed to the dig, otherwise in the order that they applied to me. We are also a bit constrained by accommodation. I do have this 20-room institute, but it's hard to get any more than, say, 19 or 20 people in the resident in the house at one time. So that's another constraint. Once we have got our team together, however, then I usually go over in advance to do all the paperwork, and they come maybe 2 weeks later, something like that. I meet them at the airport, and their worries are at an end. Then it's my worry, and we get a bus and take them the 2 hours up to Mendes, and they settle in for the next month.
Now, you said they didn't all have to be specialists in the field. I was going to ask if they all had to be either Egyptology or classics majors.
Oh, no, not in the least. I take anyone. Anyone who is really interested and who is willing to work and willing to learn. And we do have lectures from the staff on their fields of expertise. The anthropologist will talk about skeletons and mummies and things like that, and the paleobotanist will show them how she floats to get seeds and all sorts of organic material. So that every evening is filled with lectures. So they come away really having a very, very good archaeological training. They could go from my dig to any other dig and put in a respectable piece of work.
Do you ever feel as though once you have a team, a good team, and you've been working together for a while and you have a certain chemistry, that you find it difficult to let certain students go even though they're graduating and even though you know as a professor you have to integrate new students into the process all the time?
Yes. That's true. Oh, you put your finger on it. I have a couple of students who really worked out well. Boy, would I love to have them back. I'm trying to get one. She's an artist, and with any luck, she'll come back. But no, that is something. And there is this turnover, and we can't help it, of course. But over the years, and I've been at it now, the first time I went to Egypt was 49 years ago. And I've had so many teams under me, and they vary in congeniality. That's the one thing that when I go over the list with my wife, who is my deputy director, we go over the list of the people coming this year, we just wonder, my goodness, are there going to be misfits, and what's going to happen with this one and that one? It's a lot of fun, but, we have had, in time past, some teams from hell.
Are you ever the least bit anxious about letting college students, and I don't mean this in an offensive way, but of having them handle such priceless things that are thousands and thousands of years old, even as closely as you and your team supervise them?
No, I don't. Because, they're given a kind of a little mini lecture at the very outset. If something is found on the site which is fragile, then they're immediately to stop and send word back to the Institute that they need an expert to come out and help them to retrieve this object. And so, for example, one of the most common things we find are human remains, burials, very poor burials, but nevertheless they have to be treated properly. And all work stops. And we get in a very expert excavator, a local Egyptian who knows how to use a trowel and a brush, and he will clean the skeleton off completely. Then the anthropologist comes out and takes his notes, and then they very carefully take up the entire skeleton on a board and remove it back to the house. Now, the students will help. They will help the anthropologist, but they certainly... I've never had any examples of a student blundering in and destroying things. Not at all.
We'll pause for one more brief moment and be back with our final moments with Dr. Donald Redford on MTSU On the Record.
Women in Science and Engineering, or WISE, helps college women prepare for and become involved in science-related careers. WISE nurtures women's interest in these fascinating and critical fields and provides mentoring and networking opportunities. The group's main goal is to assure women of their importance in all scientific and technical fields and to promote equal opportunity and treatment of women in science. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, WISE Advisor.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
And we're back on MTSU On the Record with Dr. Donald Redford. Dr. Redford, has the economy in any way impeded your ability to finance your research?
The problems in this country, you mean?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. No, not yet. Touch wood. No, we have been able. We're not lavishly rich, obviously, but we are able to go over there and maintain ourselves with equipment and all sorts of other things that we need. Now, what's going to happen next year, I don't know. But we've been, so far, we've been very, very successful indeed. I've made a whole network of friends there in the government offices and in the local towns, and that helps very, very much, I must say, because they know that when I appear, that means some jobs for them. And I do pay my, we hire about 75 Egyptian laborers, and they get paid, obviously, and a good substantial wage.
And they trust you. It's always, isn't it interesting, it's always the personal contacts that are so important.
Oh, yes. Oh, and in Egypt especially. Oh, gosh. I mean, and now it's part of my life, too. But, I mean, once I go there, I go into an office, for example. I may have to go into several offices, and immediately I'm sat down and tea is served. And then all sorts of very friendly small talk, and one gets to the business at the very end. And then on to the next office, and more tea. And then, I've come to look forward to that. You know, it's rather a friendly, cozy atmosphere that you get.
21st century Egyptians are as interesting as ancient Egyptians.
Very much. Oh, they're a marvelous race.
Dr. Donald Redford will speak on Mendes, City of the Ram and Fish, Microcosm of Ancient Egypt at 7 p.m. October 20th in the State Farm Lecture Hall of the MTSU Business and Aerospace Building. It is free and open to the public. Thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Redford. I enjoyed it immensely.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to coming.
Okay, we'll welcome you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.